You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Dave Hodges is as mad as hell, and he's not gonna take it anymore.
I'd like to help you, Doctor, if I really would, but the din in my head, it's too much and it's no good. I'm standing in a window tunnel, shouting through the water, and I'd like to give the information, ask me for love, but blood makes noise. It's ringing in my ear, blood makes noise, and I can barely hear you in the thickening of fear.
Common sense is not so common. This is the Common Sense Show with Dave Hodges.
Welcome to hour number three, and we appreciate you staying with us. We come to you live every Sunday evening at this time from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. on the East Coast and 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. on the West Coast. This is Dave Hodges. I'm your host. You're listening to The Common Sense Show, and we are the show that is freeing America, one enslaved mind at a time. Our thanks go out to Joe Hagman for joining us in the first hour. The Hagman and Hagman Report airs here on Global Star Radio Network from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern. Ted Brower, our health expert, healthmasters.com. Dr. Ted Brower gave us a litany of things we can be doing, but I really like that summary list he left at the end of the hour. Go to healthmasters.com, and he's giving everyone a 5% discount for our listeners. DH5 is the coupon code. And no less interesting and informative, we've got Jim Wesley Rawls coming up, and we'll be joining Jim in just a minute. But I wanted to make sure that you were aware that Robert Kudla's coming on next week. Whenever I can grab this economist, I do. He has a website that you need to check out, a service you need to check out. I think anybody who sells financial products can make money in the good times. He specializes in not only doing that, but he helps people make money and, most of all, avoid catastrophe in the difficult times. And the car bubble is going to be the big thing that comes up next. We're going to be talking about that with him next week on that. But you don't have to wait next week to check out what he offers. Go to tradegenius.co. Bob Kudla, financial expert, tradegenius.co. And I got to tell you, I have set my stuff in. I'm a member now. I'm still waiting to really kind of become part of his family. But tradegenius.co is really the way to go. In these difficult times, and you don't know what to do with any excess cash you have laying around, like so many of us have it. But if you do, and if you're lucky enough, he will help you avoid the catastrophe and make the good decisions. Well, our next guest is certainly no stranger to the show. He's been on a couple of times. He has a really good website called survivalblog.com. He told me during the break, he's got 36,000 articles and other contributions, publications on that site. I mean, there is something there for everybody, probably times a thousand. Jim Wesley Rawls, thanks for joining us. And, man, how did you get so prolific?
Well, Dave, it's just a matter of persistence. If you blog every day consistently, it all piles up.
Wow. I'm envious. I always thought of myself, I'm kind of like the next coming of Lou Gehrig. I'm the Iron Man. Well, you're the Iron Man, the Ore Man, the Steel Man, the Gold Man, the Aluminum Man. You're all these rolled into one here. Yeah, I was going through some of your archives here during the commercial break, and wow, this is incredible stuff. This is a library you have here.
Well, thanks.
So, anyway,
it's
phenomenal.
I do my best to try to wake people up and inform them. And a lot of what's there actually comes from the readers. We do a bi-monthly writing contest, and we get, probably 10 or 15 articles submitted every week. And a lot of those are from subject matter experts. And it's one thing that really sets Survival Blog apart from the other blogs in the preparedness sphere. And they're all available free. The entire archives are freely available. There's no membership-only area or anything like that. It's all there free for the taking. So I highly recommend that your listeners dive in if they're interested in preparedness at all. Again, it's survivalblog.com.
Okay, survivalblog.com, and I'm on it right now. It's just simple. It's a simple layout. It's so easy to navigate. It's really good. Before we get into the current events, I like to throw a mantra at people, and I'd like you to comment on it and maybe briefly expand it. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I tell people, you know, if you're really kind of new to prep and you think things are going to go to hell in a handbasket here relatively quickly, I said things you need to look at immediately are food, water, guns, gold, ammo, medicine, a Bible. What would you add to that very quickly? Something people could get their hands on pretty quickly.
Wow. That you covered all the main points, but there's a lot that people overlook. Things like communications, because if we're talking about a grid-down environment, people are not even going to be able to talk beyond shouting distance to their neighbors. And if you're worried about a situation where there's lawlessness and you need to set up a neighborhood watch on steroids, then you need the communications to go along with that. Mm-hmm. The other thing that a lot of people overlook is night vision equipment. And if the last couple of wars in the Middle East have taught us anything, it's the importance of really effective night vision equipment. And for anyone who's already a prepper and listening to this and say, oh, I'm already dialed in, well, if you don't have night vision gear, you are behind the power curve, because unless you can operate just as effectively at night as you can in the daytime, you are going to be at a great disadvantage. I highly recommend that people, even if it means selling a couple of guns out of your gun collection to finance buying a Gen 3 night vision scope, do it, folks. It's really important.
What kind is it that you recommend on the night vision?
I think my main choice still is the PVS-14, which is a night vision monocular, and it's really versatile. It's the standard U.S. Army issue, has been for, gosh, almost 20 years now, although they're all the way up to Gen 3 Plus tubes for them now. It's a Starlight technology. It's a monocular. You can use it handheld. You can use it weapons-mounted. You can use it helmet-mounted, or you can, there's also a head mount, which is like a, almost like a hat where you can wear it. And with a PVS-14, you have tremendous light amplification. They automatically shut down if there's a bright light like a flare. And you really own the night when you have that, especially at a weapons mount.
Okay. This is good stuff to know. Well, I know on your radar from talking to you during the break, you're very concerned with what's going on in Korea, as so many of us are. So let's get your take on how you see this Korean situation unfolding and what worries you and where you think it's going.
Well, I'm hoping that Kim Jong-un is going to back down. I think he's been warned by the Chinese, but most recently, he was making noises, or at least his government was, that they were actually threatening China if China sided with the United States in the conflict. So it's really a scary situation where if Kim Jong-un goes full on, you know, bonkers and starts touching off nuclear bombs, it could be a very ugly situation, and it could come to our shores. More likely, it's going to be right on the Korean Peninsula, possibly Japan, or conceivably even with China, God forbid. It's an almost intractable situation because you have a madman at the helm.
Well, he is indeed a madman, and I guess my question is, and what I thought would happen by now is the SEAL Team 6 goes in and takes him out. am I being naive on that? I mean,
it's a monolithic state, but it's still very much a hardline communist state with their equivalent of a Politburo. And if we were to attempt something like that, I wouldn't put it past the remaining portion of that government to launch retaliatory strikes, and that could cost tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of lives before it's all over. So I unfortunately don't think that's much of an option.
Do you presume
more likely that we'll push him into a corner economically? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
That's okay, Jim. Do you presume that the rest of the government's loyal to him? Let me tell you a quick story that I know, and there's many like this. that there was a general who showed up a few years ago and had drank too much to a function. And what they did with him is they put him out on a field, had him run for his life, and they gave a cash award to the mortar crew that took him out.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, with that kind of treatment of your senior staff, wouldn't a lot of these people relish a change of leadership by any means possible?
It's such a cult of personality there. It's really hard to say because they've been kept in the dark, literally, for so long and fed such absolute hogwash propaganda. It ever since the days of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, I don't really know what their reaction will be if Kim Jong-un is taken out one way or the other, or whether if he goes bonkers or commits suicide or whatever. I just don't know what their reaction will be. They're really hard to read. It's about as far from a transparent country as you can get. It truly is opaque murk in terms of trying to get any kind of clear vision on what's going on in the government, what's going on with the North Korean psyche.
Let's talk about life in North Korea for a moment. How desperate will be these people in fighting? Will we see the fanaticism that we saw with the Japanese and the kamikaze and bonsai attacks towards the end of World War II? I mean, do we have a gauge on the spirit of the fighting forces, how sophisticated they are?
Well, a lot of them are very loyal, but a lot of their numbers are kind of inflated because the level of technology that you see on television doesn't really represent the majority of the North Korean military. A lot of the North Korean military equipment is very antiquated. You know, we're talking not even to the AK-47 level. A lot of the North Korean army is still equipped with SKS rifles. And so a lot of their rolling stock, a lot of their tanks really are not functional, but they still keep them on the books. And the threat planners still list those as if they might be still viable in combat. I'm not sure if a lot of those tanks will even start. We're talking 40, 50-year-old tanks, some of them.
So their conventional forces would be suspect in an organized fight. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right. And they're, I'm not privy to what, Z Division at Lawrence Livermore Labs has compiled in terms of their nuclear capability. But the estimates that have circulated in the press are anywhere between 5 and 12 fission bombs. They certainly are not to the fusion bomb level. As I'm sure most of your listeners know, the difference between a fission bomb and a fusion bomb, which are commonly called atom bombs versus hydrogen bombs, respectively, it's like an order of magnitude in terms of power. And the level of sophistication just isn't there. So not only do they only have fission bombs, not fusion bombs, they don't have hydrogen bombs, they're also not very compact. I really have doubts that they would be able to, with their current missiles, actually deliver one of their fission bombs at any kind of distance. I just don't see that happening. More likely, they would, either load one onto a bomber or possibly a cargo plane for a kamikaze-style attack, or more likely, they would put them on board a ship and, sail them to a port city that they wanted to destroy, and then touch one off there. That's more the level of technology they have. There's also been a lot of hyperbole about them touching off a nuclear bomb at high altitude for maximizing the EMP effect over the United States. And it's true they do have satellites, but they do not have the capability, so far as I know, to put a nuclear bomb into orbit. They just don't have that kind of lift capability because their bombs are crude and very large. We're talking maybe half the size of either the Hiroshima or Nagasaki bomb of World War II. So they're still huge.
If they could, and if you had two Korean satellites orbiting over mid-continental North America, and they had a low-level burst at 150 miles, it would still take out most of the grid.
Well,
but
yes,
I agree with you. I think it's problematic for them to carry that out technologically.
Yeah, technologically, I don't think they're quite there. If it's conceivable they could have one on board a bomber aircraft, and they could fly a parabolic you know, flight profile and touch one off at apogee, and that would be at maybe 70, 75,000 feet max, mm-hmm. if you know, if somebody was really suicidal. But so that would give a footprint for that EMP at say 65,000 feet. We're looking at roughly a 200 to 300 mile radius for that EMP for line of sight. You'd still have coupling of EMP beyond line of sight. And if you go back through the survival blog archives, I actually have a formula in there for determining the line of sight effects of nuclear weapons based on the altitude that it's touched off.
That's, yeah, and as I think this through here, and you're given a side to consider, everyone talks about their potential, but technologically, I'd hate to underestimate them. We have a lot more to fear from a cargo ship coming in with a nuke into LA port than we
yes.
do having them fly over the United States. But, Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, don't we have really sophisticated technology that can track nuclear weapons, that it's almost impossible to mask the radiation effect?
Well, you can shield if you have enough. If you put a nuclear weapon into a cargo container and you have enough shielding around it, it's not going to show up at all, regardless of what technology you throw at it. There just won't be enough gamma escaping to be detectable. Now, on board an aircraft, there's no way you could have enough shielding because there's no aircraft that could carry that amount of weight. We do have, from published sources, we do have instruments in orbit on non-air breathing platforms where they're watching for that sort of thing on board aircraft. But if it's coming in by ship and it's well shielded, it would be essentially undetectable until you actually had someone board the ship with instruments that would, you know, you have Geiger counters or whatever where you're up close and personal. Beyond that, they're just not going to be detectable.
Well, Jim, on their nuclear submarines, believe there, I've read 50 involved, but a few years ago I recall reading that they seem to have some unique ability to shield themselves from detection, and combining that with the Day of Sun parade, where the so-called experts who looked at the photographs of the parade said that, oh my gosh, they have nuclear ballistic missile capability for their submarines. If we put those two things together, does that give us another variable to worry about in the present moment?
Well, anyone that has a capability to get below 30 or 40 feet of depth is going to have fantastic shielding, because water itself is the ideal shielding for radiation. In fact, that's why they use cooling ponds at nuclear power plants. It's why you can actually look down into the pond safely and look at the actual nuclear pile rods sitting there. You've only got 15 feet of water, 20 feet of water between you and the fissile materials, because water itself is great shielding. And if you have any submarine carrying a nuclear weapon, as long as it's below probably even 15 or 20 feet of depth, if it's 30 feet down, that's going to be indetectable as well. Now, I have serious doubts, though, that they have true sub-launch capability. They probably have to surface to launch with most of their missile technology. And as I mentioned earlier, they just don't have the capability to put one of their current generation of nuclear weapons into a missile and actually have it successfully launch and reach a target. They just don't have, it would take an enormous rocket to do that. And I just have serious doubts about that level of technology. I may be wrong, but from what I've been reading for the last 5 or 10 years, they are still 10 to 20 years away from that.
Okay, well, let's
certainly they're not going to have MIRVs like we do.
Yeah, I hear you, but it only takes one. I mean, I'm going to ask this question and then I'll put a caveat on it, but if the submarines are hard to detect, and I've read that they are, and if they could load some kind of nuclear device in there, and they could deliver it to a port.
Sure.
Would this be their best chance of delivering a nuclear attack on American soil? Is
probably,
that their number
yes.
one option?
Well, if they're willing to sacrifice, they don't have, you know, that most of the submarines in their fleet are actually traditional diesel electric subs. And if they were willing to sacrifice one of their latest generation subs, yes, that would be their very best chance of getting one into harbor, because they could sneak it in at depth, at least for the last couple of hundred miles they needed to travel, and cozy right up into an American port, surface, and kaboom. And then you'd have a nice ground burst.
Would you get a tsunami?
No, you'd have a really big fireball, and that fireball would be in contact with the surface. And if you were right in port, that would mean, if you're right up to a pier, that would mean that one half of the fireball would be in contact with the ground, with the shoreline, which would throw up a tremendous amount of fallout. As I'm sure most of your listeners know, when a nuclear weapon is detonated, if it's an airburst and the fireball does not touch the ground, then you only have the direct radiation effects and the blast that are impacting the ground, and it won't kick up fallout, or at least not any significant amount of fallout. It's only when you have a ground burst or a low air burst that you have a true fallout type situation where you kick up and immediately, you know, you're ionizing, you're irradiating all that soil that's being kicked up, and that becomes the fallout that is then gradually deposited downwind. Most of the American okay. targeting under current Air Force doctrine is for airbursts, not ground bursts. So if we were to retaliate against North Korea, chances are, unless there were specific deep targets we were after, we would do most of our retaliation in the form of airbursts.
What about the MOAB that we saw in Afghanistan?
The MOAB is kind of an unusual weapon in that it really, I was talking earlier about how North Korea doesn't have a nuclear weapon that would fit inside a missile. Well, we don't have a MOAB that'll fit inside a bomber. The MOAB that was dropped on Afghanistan was actually dropped out of a large cargo aircraft, because that bomb is like 20 feet long. There's not a bomb bay in the American inventory of aircraft that can accommodate the MOAB. So the only way we can deliver it is from a cargo plane. So it really limits our options. You know, it would be nuts to try to use the MOAB device over North Korea, because we don't control the airspace. It was able to be used in Afghanistan because we have air superiority there. We certainly don't and wouldn't for quite a long time in a campaign against North Korea until we knock down their air defenses. So the MOAB really is kind of off the table for North Korea, unless you're going to take a huge risk of losing both aircraft and air crew.
Interesting. I didn't realize the logistic problem was there. I thought the MOAB was dropped as a warning to the North Korean leadership. There's nowhere you can run and hide, so you better be good.
Well, I think it, you know, politically and psychologically, it was a fantastic show of force. But from a pragmatic standpoint, we would have to be using other weapons. And we have nuclear weapons that make the MOAB seem like a firecracker by comparison.
That's true. But to me, in the court of public opinion worldwide, a lot better to use the MOAB than a nuke, at least from a public relations standpoint.
It would be politically suicidal for any American president to use nuclear weapons in any situation other than a retaliatory strike following a major nuclear attack on the United States. I'm not sure if it'd be politically survivable, even if just one American city was hit by a nuclear weapon. If we were to retaliate with a nuclear option, I'm not sure that would be politically survivable for any American president, simply because nuclear weapons are considered anathema.
I think it's a good anathema. But I've got another anathema that appeared out of the Russian media. And I was shocked by this. And there's been a YouTube video made about it. And I duplicated it, not because I believe it's true, but because it was said. And I wanted to maybe explore with you the reasons why it was said. What was said was that Russia has secretly lined the U.S. coastline with nuclear moles that will go off on command. Now, I think the probability of that is very low. You'd have to have inside help, and I don't know that you'd even, with the deep state as corrupted as it is, you'd find them participating in something that bad. But why would Russian media release this? Such obvious nonsense propaganda. What would you think about that?
Yeah, that's really hard to figure why they would do that. And I agree with you. The chances of them actually having done that are fairly low. Although, the Russians many, many years ago, back in the early 60s, this is before the days of satellite communications, they got in the business of building special submarines, including some crawling submarines that were designed to tap into undersea communications cables. So they're actually I think on a par with the United States in terms of their submarine bottom capability, in terms of actually having crawlers or seafloor excavation equipment. I think they probably are on a par with the United States. So I wouldn't put it past them to have developed that level of technology. How they could have stealthily gotten all the way to the U.S. coast and positioned weapons that way is kind of dubious.
Yeah, wouldn't it take some sophisticated construction that would draw attention?
Well, not particularly. You know, like, for example, there was a bomber that was a nuclear bomb that was actually accidentally dropped. I believe it was off the coast of Greenland back in the 1970s.
Right.
And it wasn't recovered until just recently. It was lost. It was gone. The U.S. Navy spent years, and Lord knows how many man years. It was probably measured in the thousands of man years searching for this this lost nuclear weapon that had been dropped. It, of course, didn't detonate. It was just sitting there on the sea floor, but you know, the depths of the sea are still kind of a mystery. We don't have full visibility of everything that's going on with our coastline. If you look at it from a fractal standpoint, the miles of coastline of the United States are probably 4 or 5 times as high as the official listed dimensions of our littoral, simply because of the fractal geometry of the coastline itself. There's a ton of nooks and crannies there, where if they were able to get a submarine in close and they, if they were to leave a device below 50 feet of depth, it could sit there undetected, and they wouldn't even have to bury it necessarily, more than just a token depth, for it to be pretty well invisible. So it's not, you know, inconceivable that they could have done this. I'm just not thinking it's very likely.
Okay. I think you're right. So what about the, since North Korea, we've said the nuclear threat is going to be a little bit on the remote side. It's going to be difficult to pull off. What about chemical and biological and agents within our country?
That could very well be. I'm actually more concerned about Islamic terrorism and Islamic sleeper cells than I am North Korean. Because one oddity of the North Korean state is that it has been just incredibly xenophobic. Their overseas intelligence gathering is limited to just a few embassies, most of those are in closed countries. They really don't have that much of a presence outside of their own country. They're so xenophobic. They're so worried about people fleeing their own country. They're so worried about secrecy that there's very little diplomatic contact. There's very little trade contact. And there's also very little academic exchange contact that goes on with North Korea. Most countries, even radical countries like Iran, have foreign students at universities in Europe and in the United States. Not so with North Korea. I mean, there's just a handful of people that are involved in academic exchange. So they really don't have enough of a flow of people back and forth to have infiltrated a large number of sleeper agents. But in contrast, unfortunately, coming out of the Islamic world, there are tens of thousands of Islamic students attending university or have dropped off the radar while attending university in the United States and in Western Europe. That's actually my greater concern right now. I think that's the real cadre of sleeper agents that I'm fairly confident exists.
Well, here's what I've wondered, and I'll cut right to the chase on this. You've got nuclear capability with North Korea. You've got the means to, you've got the army and the back and forth flow traffic that you've talked about to bring agents in. North Korea and ISIS partnering up, perhaps, to deliver a nuke to our shore?
It's conceivable. I mean, if you look at the terror networks that existed ever since the 1960s, where you had just these strange bedfellows, you know, you had the Baader-Meinhof gang cross-training with Islamics. They had nothing in common other than a hatred of the West and all that it stands for. But yet they cooperated together, and they traded weapons, they traded explosives, they traded training. So that kind of relationship, I think, is definitely possible. I haven't been in the intelligence community recently, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you what I've been privy to, but that certainly wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, very, very. The Korean thing is just so volatile. Well, I'd like to bring our discussion down, if we could, for a moment, and just talk about individual preparation. The last time you were on the show, and forgive me if I get the miles wrong, but I think that you said something like, if you really want to be safe, be 200 miles or more away from a major city.
That's a pretty safe figure. I'd rather be 300 or 400 miles away, but that doesn't leave a lot of the United States.
I was going to say, where are you going to? Yeah, I thought I was doing good. I'm 20, 22 miles north of metropolitan Phoenix, northwest. And I thought I was doing okay, but I need 10 times the room. But if I go as far as you're saying, I don't know that I can get away from a major city.
Yeah, as I've often mentioned in my radio interviews, Dave, the inverse square law has not been repealed.
And yes, exactly.
So the farther you are from cities, the less likely you are to see problems. You're certainly much farther away from likely terrorist or nation state nuclear targets, chemical, biological weapon targets. You're well removed from those. And if you're a couple hundred miles away from any major city, that's a lot of countryside for people to disperse themselves into if there is some huge catastrophe that takes down the power grids and people flee the cities. They're going to be thinned out tremendously by the time they ever get out 200 miles. You won't have some huge wave of refugees coming right at you unless you're along one of the major transportation corridors. So for someone like me living in the inland Northwest, you know, it's just something I'm going to hear about if there is such an event. I'll hear about it through, you know, my ham radio and Citizens Band radio contacts, but it's not something I'm going to see face to face. I'm just too far out. And people just, they tend to follow natural lines of drift when they get in a refugee situation. And if you're off of the major lines of drift, if you're away from the major highways, the major rivers, away from railway lines, your chances of even encountering someone who's out looting or some desperate refugee is just going to be almost non-existent. Now, if you're right in the suburbs, if you're 20 miles away from a major metropolitan region, you're in walking distance, and you're going to be seeing people in depth. You'll be seeing thousands and thousands of people, a lot of them probably very desperate, and that wouldn't be a very enviable position. You'd have to be prepared to hunker down probably for a couple of years. If it's a worst-case scenario that involves this grid down and the grid doesn't come up, you're going to have to wait for a die-off before it's even going to be survivable if you're only 20 miles out of a major city.
Talk to me about a die-off. Can you explain what you mean by that specifically?
Sure. Well, we live in a very fragile, technologically complex society that's now incredibly dependent on both the power grids, and there's three of them, and the internet and modern telecommunications. If the grids go down and stay down, within just a few weeks, you're going to have a mass die-off that begins in the major cities, starting with people who are chronically ill, people who are on medical insulin, people who are on CPAP machines, people who are on kidney dialysis, people who are on medical oxygen, and of course, just a huge number of people who are chemically dependent on, you know, some people are on, you know, I talk to elderly people, they say, well, I have trouble keeping track of my pills. I'm on 16 different pills. Well, if that supply gets cut off, we're talking about a major die-off just of the chronically ill. We also have a huge number of people who are chronically obese. We also have a large number of people who are mentally ill and only being treated chemically. Things don't look very good for those folks. I think we'll see a fairly large die-off. We'll see a lot of elderly people die. We'll see a lot of people chronically ill die. And since your average urbanite only has 3 days' worth of food on hand, and their houses are heated either directly or indirectly with electricity, if we have a grid-down event and it spans a winter, especially in the northern United States, we might see a die-off as great as 60 or 70% of the population by the end of that winter.
I know the Naval War College said if we ever had an EMP attack, we could expect 90% fatalities within 2 years. So, I mean, we're in the same ballpark with these catastrophic projections.
Yeah, you know, there'll be some areas that will be fairly well spared. I actually live in one of them because I live in the inland Northwest where we have plentiful hydroelectric power, and even if the national grids go down, our local power co-op is all set up to, you know, flip the switch and reestablish a local power grid. So there'll be islands of light in all that darkness. The rest of the country is going to go pretty well black. And it very well could result, if the grids don't come back up, in a massive die-off.
I read this, so I have you here to tell us if this is true. After you get past the initial, we're going to come break into your house and kill you for your resources situation, and as you progress deeper into a catastrophe where the grid is down, is the major cause of death waterborne illnesses?
I think a lot of it will be, yes, because unlike third world countries that are used to having power failures regularly, we have a very pampered society and a very urbanized society where the majority of people don't even have the common sense to dig latrines, and they'll be fouling their own water supplies. So we could have, things that would look like make the cholera epidemics of years ago seem mild by comparison. We could have huge loss of life from sanitation problems. And in different regions, we'll have other, contributing factors. In the Southwest, we'll have a lot of people dying of thirst. In the Northeast and across the plains, we'll probably see a lot of people dying from exposure from the cold. So it's, I know it doesn't sound very cheery to your listeners, but people need to think these threats through and recognize that we do have manifold threats, and the only mitigation is going to be at the family level, because governments have proven time and time again they're incapable of providing any kind of aid in the event of a disaster. And we have a situation where any city over about 5,000 population is going to lack the internal cohesion and have the public health crisis of a disrupted water supply and disrupted sewage systems, where any city over about 5,000 population probably won't even be inhabitable. So you're going to have huge refugee flows, and you're going to have a lot of very desperate people hitting the road all at once. And once they run out of gas or get stuck in traffic and run out of gas, they're going to be on foot, which limits them to just what they can carry, which gives them about a week's food supply. And once that's expended, then your average refugee is going to very quickly turn into your average looter. It's not going to be a very pretty situation at all.
Interesting. Well, what will happen with nuclear power plants in a grid down situation? Are the catastrophes I read about from Congressman Franks a scenario?
I think he's absolutely right.
Well, most of them do melt down eventually.
It's not the nuclear power plants themselves. It's the spent fuel ponds. Because right now, they have a tremendous amount of fissile material that's the rods that are used in these power plants are suspended in these spent fuel ponds. The spent fuel ponds only maintain those rods because there's water constantly circulating with electric pumps in huge volumes to keep that water cool. If the pumps stop, within an hour, those ponds are going to reach a boil. The water is going to boil off. They won't be able to contain it. Most of these spent fuel ponds only have the equivalent of a patio roof over them. It's a very flimsy roof. Once the rods are exposed to the air, they are going to reach tremendous temperature, melt down, and explode in steam explosions, throwing these rods all around, just like what happened at Fukushima. There at Fukushima, most people don't realize it, we were lucky that those plants were not a designated facility for large-scale storage of spent fuel rods. If they had been, like most of our nuclear power plants are, the disaster would have been much larger.
So So what I'm hearing, could we have 120 meltdowns? Actually, 104 in America, 124, I believe, U.S. and Canada. Is this what we're looking at if we have a grid down for any length of time?
Yes, although, a lot of nuclear power plants would be able to reconstitute and provide their own power and island to themselves. But strangely, what most people don't realize is that under NRC regulations, nuclear power plants are required by law to go offline if the larger power grid goes down, or if their staffing drops below a certain level. So say we had a pandemic or biological warfare situation, or even conceivably a societal collapse that makes it unsafe for the nuclear power plant staff to commute back and forth to work. By NRC regulations, they're required to scram those piles, shut down those plants once they're below a certain level of staffing. They legally cannot operate unless they're at 80% of their staff or better.
Well, let's hope they all follow that, because we've seen what one Fukushima can do. If you had multiple, it's crazy. Now, I did talk to someone who works in a nuclear power plant who's given me information, you know, through the years, pretty generic information. But one of the things that he recently told me was they're getting increased visits from Homeland. And that tells me they're worried about sabotage. I mean, would you think that's a reasonable assumption to make? That,
yes, certainly.
Yeah.
It's kind of a two-edged sword that we live in a free society, because one of those freedoms is the freedom of travel. And we have open borders. We have a tremendous number of tourists and, as I mentioned earlier, exchange students in this country, any one of whom could be a sleeper agent. And if you look at the way most of our power grid is set up, it's really not well protected. It's just chain link fences and padlocks that's protecting most of it. It's not even, there's no armed guards, except at nuclear power plants where there are armed guards. Most of our power generation and transmission facilities are essentially unguarded. We have a society that has set up power grid that's essentially on the honor system, that they expect people to be well behaved and not go tearing things apart. There's really not a lot that stands between all of our power substations, for example, and the general public, other than a chain link fence. You could stand off with a high power deer rifle, and you could take in 2 minutes' time, you could take a typical power substation offline with 30 or 40 rounds of ammunition.
Didn't that kind of thing happen in California? They took down a power grid with what you're describing?
Well, it didn't drop the full grid, but the FBI has been very busy ever since trying to figure out who did it and how they were able to do it, and they've been very, very quiet, because that same event could be replicated nationwide. If you had well-organized sleeper cells, they could take out 80% of our power substations in one night if they were very well organized, and if the sleeper cells were literally numbering in the thousands. Say you give each cell two or three targets for one night, and they could take out a huge chunk of our power grid, and most importantly, the power to our major cities, in just one night. And a lot of those transformers that they would be hitting, there aren't enough spares to rebuild even a tenth of that. And some of the larger transformers, the same ones that EMP would take out, there are hardly any spares. The lead time to order those is about a 3 or 4 year lead time, and a lot of them are produced overseas.
In China, of all places.
Some of them come from China, some of them come from Europe. And some of these big transformers just don't go on a regular truck. It's considered a mega load. It requires special coordination to get those transformers on the highway because it requires a trailer with like 48 wheels in there. It's an enormous load to get one of those on a highway. You don't just go shuttling those around rapidly. Even if we had space, which we don't.
This reminds me of the song from Simon and Garfunkel, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, only it's 1,000 Ways to Kill Your Nation. I mean, this is how I want to go back to Korea for a second, and through our discussion here, something did occur to me. Let's assume the reports we're getting from AP are true. The Russians have amassed at the border, and they're engaged in plausible deniability. Do you think there's any chance, since Russia may feel isolated because China and the U.S. are now partnering up on Korea, do you think maybe that turns Russia to North Korea and they become a state ally?
It's conceivable. But given the really deep rift in Sino-Soviet relations over the years, I really don't think the Russians trust the Chinese or the North Koreans. And it's conceivable that they could, pivot in that direction. The likelihood of that, though, it doesn't seem very high to me. And what does Russia really have to gain? North Korea has a completely isolated economy. Their only real export to speak of is coal, and it's not shipped out by sea. It goes out by land transport to China. There really isn't any real advantage to Russia other than possibly securing a couple of more year-round warm water ports. That's the only
And under the Mackinder hypothesis, that makes a little bit of sense. You know, we got to close on this, but one thing I will tell you that I've read and I do believe, Russia did turn to Iran right away because they're assisting them with two nuclear power plants, and my suspicious mind says it's not just nuclear power plants eventually. So I don't think Russia's going to sit there and not act while China and the U.S. forge an alliance.
Yeah, if you look at Russian foreign policy in the long view, ever since Napoleonic days, their real goal has been to secure warm water ports. That's always been the real shortcoming of Russia,
exactly.
The Soviet Union, and now Russia again. That's always been their long-term quest. And if you look at the way they've treated the Middle East, especially the Caspian Sea, and their whole southern flank, their whole strategy has been geared around the long-term goal of securing warm water ports.
And Jim, with that, our warm water port has come to an end. We've docked and we're offloading. We're at the end of the show, I'm afraid. I want to thank you for joining us, urbansurvival.com. I gave that out right correctly.
No, it's survivalblog.com.
Sorry about that. Survivalblog.com. I read off the wrong list here, and we are out of time. I'll put that up on the show release. Thanks so much for joining us. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much, Dave, and God bless you and your listeners.
Thank you. We'll see you back here next week, everybody. Go out and have a great week. God bless.